This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. May 17th will mark the 50th anniversary of Brown v. Board of Education, the Supreme Court decision that declared state-sanctioned segregation of the schools to be unconstitutional. This decision overturned Plessy v. Ferguson, the 1896 decision that legally sanctioned Jim Crow laws by saying that separate but equal facilities were acceptable. The challenge to school segregation was mounted by the NAACP's Legal Defense and Educational Fund, which was headed by Thurgood Marshall. Marshall later became the first African-American Supreme Court justice. In the early 50s, before the NAACP's challenges, 17 states required racial segregation of public schools. Four others permitted local districts to impose it. Brown is a landmark decision in the history of civil rights, but 50 years after the ruling, many of our schools and our neighborhoods are still divided by race, even though they are not officially segregated. My guest, James T. Patterson, is the author of Brown v. Board of Education, A Civil Rights Milestone and Its Troubled Legacy. He's a professor emeritus of history at Brown University. Brown v. Board of Education wasn't just one family's challenge about the schools. There were actually five cases covered in that decision. Can you give us an overview of what those five cases were and why there were five cases that were argued?
Yeah, there were five cases. As you say, they involved the best known, which was the Topeka, Kansas case. That's where Linda Brown, the little girl, little black girl, is the Brown of Brown versus Board of Education. And she lived in a mixed-race neighborhood, but because of segregation in Topeka affecting only elementary schools, it was not segregation in the middle schools or the high school. She was then an elementary school child, the age of seven. She wanted to be able to go to her neighborhood school. Instead, she was bused. Parents didn't want busing to a all-black school quite a distance away. It was much more inconvenient and dangerous and cold and so forth. That was the essence of the Kansas case. Then there was one in the District of Columbia. There was one in South Carolina. There was one in the southern part of the state of Virginia. And there was one in Delaware, Wilmington, Delaware area. So there were these five cases, and they were all amalgamated. They were heard by federal district judges in 1951 and 52. And then they went to the Supreme Court, amalgamated in December of 1952. The court couldn't make up its mind. It decided to rehear the cases in the fall of 1953. And this was finally done in December of 1953 for the second time. By this time, Earl Warren had become Chief Justice because the former Chief Justice, Fred Vinson, had died in September of 1953. And the court finally made its decision, as you know, on May 17th, 1954.
What was the NAACP's approach to arguing this case and for arguing against Plessy versus Ferguson, the decision that sanctioned legal segregation?
Well, the main constitutional argument was that segregation violated the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which was ratified during the period of Radical Reconstruction in 1868. And the most famous aspect of that amendment is that no state may deprive a person of life, liberty, or property without due process or deny people the equal protection of the laws. So at the heart of the argument was this constitutional argument. There were also arguments used, as you know, by Thurgood Marshall and the other lawyers that segregation was damaging psychologically to black children. And that was used particularly in the Kansas case leading up to the Brown case and in Delaware. Not all of the lawyers in the NAACP and in the Legal Defense Fund thought much of the argument. And later on, when you got into a black power phase of the civil rights movement, there was a lot of rejection of this on the part of blacks who said, there's nothing wrong with us psychologically. We're tough enough to deal with segregation. We've been dealing with all kinds of oppression for several centuries, and this research is inaccurate. But it was used in the Brown cases, and it was also cited, the Clark's research was cited in a famous footnote 11 of the Brown versus Board decision written by Earl Warren.
When Brown was first brought to the Supreme Court. The Chief Justice was Fred Vinson. By the time it was actually argued, the Chief Justice was Earl Warren. Fred Vinson had died. Did that change the dynamic within the court?
Yes, the sudden and unexpected death of Chief Justice Vinson in September 1953, who died very suddenly in his Washington hotel apartment, definitely changed the situation. Vinson had been appointed by Truman to the Chief Justiceship in 1946. He, prior to that time, had been a very prominent Kentucky congressman and then a leading administrator during World War II, and then Truman's Secretary of the Treasury. They were very close friends, Truman and Vinson were. But Vinson turned out to be a very unsuccessful Chief Justice. His colleagues, for the most part, did not feel very respectful toward him. He was unable to heal serious personal rifts among the judges or to bring to the court any sort of unified approach to a number of cases. Many people blame him for that, but these were difficult times. At any rate, Vinson was not in favor of overturning Plessy. So at the time of his death, most historians think that if the court had been forced to decide Brown versus Board in 1952 when they first heard it, or if they'd had to decide it in 1953 when they reheard it under Vinson, at most they might have expected a 5-4, maybe a 6-3 majority in favor of overturning segregation. And some people weren't even sure they could get a majority. What Warren did, and he was a very genial, politically astute, and highly motivated opponent of segregation, what Warren did from the time he came on the court in October 1953 as Eisenhower's appointee until the decision was finally read in May of 1954 was to work very hard to make this the first important decision of his tenure and to achieve, if possible, unanimity among the justices so that a decision against segregation would have the force of a unanimous court. That was felt to be very important at the time. And Warren really did work wonders. It's not often historians would say that or attribute so much importance to the role of a single individual in history. But I believe, and most historians believe, that he deserves the credit for having done that.
Chief Justice Earl Warren wrote the decision. What do you think are the most inspiring parts of the decision he wrote?
Most people then and since do not regard it as an inspiring piece of writing. It was a very short decision, as Supreme Court decisions go, only 11 pages. The Miranda decision involving criminal rights, for instance, in 1966 was many, many times longer than that, 60-odd-something pages, I think. I forget exactly what. Warren wanted to keep it simple. He wanted to focus on public education and not denounce racism in general or deal with the question of de facto racial segregation in the non-Southern states. He didn't want to say anything that would blame the South or single white Southerners out as being particularly racist. So there are no really sort of, you know, bell-ringing, earth-shattering phrases in there that people tend to cite. He focused rather upon the growth of public education over time in the United States and argued that public education was just about the most important thing a person needed to get on in life, and went on to say that in the field of education, segregation was wrong. And then, of course, the footnotes did say some things concerning the psychological disadvantages. But it's not a inspiring decision in terms of its language.
Do you think he intentionally...
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I think he did, yes, intentionally want to keep it simple and keep it non-inflammatory.
The court handed down the decision on Brown v. Board of Ed in 1954, but in 1955, the court handed down a related decision. Why did the court have to go back to Brown v. Board of Ed again a year later?
Yes, the Brown decision in 1954, unlike most Supreme Court decisions, left unsaid the very key questions as to when and under what circumstances its decree against racial segregation in the schools should go into effect. I say this is unusual because usually the court, when it makes a decision, says, look, what you people have been doing is wrong, if that's what they decide, and you've got to fix it. But the fact that they didn't was one sign of the tension that had existed in the court. We don't have any evidence to suggest that this was any kind of conscious deal that Warren was able to strike in order to achieve unanimity. But it's clear that the court's unanimity was facilitated in 1954 because Warren made it clear that the court would not, in fact, in 1954, decide when and under what circumstances the desegregation would be carried out. Instead, he made it clear that they would rehear the case later that year and issue a decision sometime in 1955, which would, in fact, decide how this would be implemented. And as you know, in May 1955, a year later, they issued the so-called Brown Roman numeral II, Brown versus the Board of Education II, which decided that desegregation of the public schools, where school segregation had been mandated by law, this should be carried out with all deliberate speed. This, as you also know, was a vague and, as far as most blacks like Thurgood Marshall were concerned, very unsatisfactory resolution of this issue because it didn't establish any deadline. The NAACP people had hoped for a deadline of the opening of the school year 1955-56 or at the latest the opening of the school year 56-57. The court did not establish any specific date, and this therefore encouraged further, or it's so it's thought, encouraged further Southern white resistance. Although I would have to say, and others would say, I think that whatever the court had decided in 1955, there would have been, and there was, fierce resistance to school desegregation.
I confess, I don't really understand what the court meant by all deliberate speed. I don't know whether that means make it snappy or deliberate. Take your time, you know, do what you need to do. Don't worry about speed.
Well, you're not the only one who doesn't understand it. Because, of course, deliberate means with deliberation, take your time. And speed means quickly. It was a very unclear and vague and unhelpful phrase. Marshall put on a good face, Thurgood Marshall put on a good face at the time and said, well, this isn't so bad. But later on, he realized what some people realized at the time, that the phrase all deliberate speed was so vague that it permitted or encouraged Southern resistance to school desegregation. Much later, he used to tell his law clerks that he finally understood what all deliberate speed meant. It meant S-L-O-W. And that's exactly what did happen. But as I said before, I don't know that if the court had said, okay, do it tomorrow or do it this year, I think the resistance would have been as fierce and as overwhelming as it was.
My guest is James T. Patterson, author of Brown versus Board of Education, A Civil Rights Milestone and Its Troubled Legacy. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Patterson. He's a professor emeritus of history at Brown University and author of the book Brown versus Board of Education, A Civil Rights Milestone and Its Troubled Legacy. Okay, so after Brown versus Board of Education, when the Supreme Court made it illegal to segregate the schools, there were attempts in Congress to get around that. What did some congressmen try to do to get around Brown v. Board of Ed?
The most famous effort by the Congress was the so-called Southern Manifesto, which was signed in March of 1956 by, I think, 101 of the Southern representatives. This was a huge majority of the Southern representatives. And by 19 of the 22 Southern senators, all Democrats, of course, at that time, in the so-called Southern Solid South. The only senators who didn't sign were Senator Al Gore Sr. of Tennessee, Estes Key Faubor of Tennessee, and Lyndon Johnson of Texas. All three of these people had national aspirations either to be presidential candidates or vice presidential candidates in the case of Gore. All the rest, however, signed it. What the manifesto said was that the South would use all legal means to contest this bad decision. So it was a formal statement on the part of Congress that encouraged local people in the South to think that their representatives and senators would be behind them when they resisted implementation of the decision.
I should mention that Strom Thurmond, who went on to have a very long career in Congress, was one of the people who signed the Southern Manifesto.
That's right.
What's an example of one of the dodges that the Southern Manifesto helped, quote, legitimize?
One of them was so-called pupil placement laws. As you know, education is profoundly a local matter in the United States. It's predominantly supported by local taxes and run by local school officials. Sometimes there's a little bit of state aid, but it's never been much, and at that time there was no federal aid to speak of. So the implementation of Brown or the non-implementation of it was left to local school officials and local political officials. And they would design these so-called pupil placement tests, and they would bring kids in during the summer or before the start of a school year and give them these tests, from which they deduced that certain kids should go to school X and certain kids should go to school Y. And with remarkable consistency, what these tests did was end up placing all the black kids in black schools and all the white kids in white schools, just as it always been the case. Maybe they might offer a tiny bit of token desegregation, that is to say, admitting a very small handful, 2, 3, 5, black kids to a white school, so that they could say, look, we're not violating the law, we've desegregated. But there were other things. After that, in the 60s, a major means of avoiding the implications of the Brown decision was so-called freedom of choice plans. And what this meant was that kids were told, parents were told, that their kids had freedom of choice. They could go to whatever school they wanted to in their districts. But in fact, what happened all the time, or almost all the time, again, there were a few exceptions, there was token desegregation in some of these cases, was that the black parents didn't dare send their kids, and many of the black kids didn't want to dare to go to the all-white schools, and virtually no white parents ever chose, under freedom of choice plans, to send their kids to black schools. So their freedom of choice plans had the same impact as the pupil placement laws, which is to say, no desegregation.
In the early years after Brown v. Board of Ed, the South, many people in the South called many people in the North hypocrites, because the North actually had a lot of segregated schools, but they were segregated not because of legally mandated segregation, they just because of geography and race and class and all of those issues ended up being segregated. Can you talk a little bit about what that argument was like? In the 50s and 60s.
Yes, as you say, many, many white Southerners and people generally resented being singled out as more racist than Northern whites, where de facto segregation based upon residential segregation. And I should point out that they had a point, because the de facto segregation in the North was not always or necessarily or usually accidental. Northern districts for many years had established school districts, the siting of new schools when they're built, transportation routes, and various other ways to ensure, in many cases, a minimum of mixing between whites and blacks in the schools. So de facto segregation was in some ways the result of legal and official and political decisions. It was not just accidental. So the South had a very good point there.
I want to read the quote that you end your book with. And this is a quote from Jack Greenberg, who was one of the NAACP lawyers who argued Brown v. Board of Ed. And the quote is, "Altogether, school desegregation has been a story of conspicuous achievements flawed by marked failures, the causes of which lie beyond the capacity of lawyers to correct. Lawyers can do right, they can do good, but they have their limits. The rest of the job is up to society. Why did you want to end your book on Brown v. Board of Ed with that quote?
Well, I agree with it. It reflects what I've already mentioned, that litigation is a what I would call a necessary strategy as part of a civil rights improvements in this country. You have to have the law on your side, and the Brown case was very important as a constitutional precedent which overruled, at least as far as schools was concerned, the Plessy decision. But litigation is slow. More than litigation was needed to get the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965. It involved the civil rights movement and direct action. Without this kind of grassroots, powerful, local political pressure, without mobilization, without organization, without moral passion, going beyond the courts, it's difficult to get a whole lot accomplished in race relations. That's what Greenberg meant. That's what I mean.
James Patterson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
James T. Patterson is a professor emeritus of history at Brown University. His book is called Brown v. Board of Education, A Civil Rights Milestone and Its Troubled Legacy. In the second half of the show, we'll hear from Jack Greenberg, who I just quoted. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.